It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps. In neighborhoods across the country, voting has begun. And already one thing is clear about this election. People are paying a lot more attention to where and when and how they vote.
So I just dropped off my absentee ballot here at James Madison Park.
In Madison, Wisconsin, there are poll workers in the parks.
It's a really cool concept that you can go to any park in the neighborhood and vote. So we pop by on our bike.
It's something that I need to do because it's important, and I wanted to show up for myself and other people.
This is my first time voting. I've been here for 20 years. I wasn't able to vote, and because I became a citizen now, I can vote. I want to have a voice, so this is my way to say I'm planting my small seed in there.
Even a pandemic can't stop democracy. But this is definitely a whole different kind of election, for a lot of reasons. And frankly, I think a lot of us are ready for it all to be over. I mean, normally, I would be feeling pretty nervous about Election Day. This year, it's the day after I'm more worried about. And so is constitutional law scholar Kim Whaley.
We will probably see a lot of lawsuits. The Republicans will probably challenge mail-in voting.
They want to steal an election. That's all this is all about. They want to steal the election.
Millions and millions of people are going to be voting by mail because of the pandemic.
But lawsuits can take forever. Is there an end date?
The key deadlines are December 8th and then December 14th.
Marking my calendar.
December 14th is the date on which the electors are supposed to meet and cast their slates of electors for president.
As an elector, I can look at the Emoluments Clause and say, no.
But if there isn't a clear winner in the state because there is still some question as to whether ballots are properly counted, they're still in the process or it's in litigation, federal law allows state legislatures by December 8th to basically change the law and decide we are going to give our electors to Donald Trump or to Joe Biden, regardless of the popular vote.
Wait, they can do that?
Votes are 10 votes, Donald J. Trump.
Now, it's possible that, say, a Republican legislature could do that, and a Democratic governor would say, no, actually, I'm going to wait for the popular vote. Then we would have a contested election that would go to the United States Congress.
The House will be in order.
Every state gets one vote, and that vote is determined by how many members of the House of Representatives are in one party over another.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
But if the election's contested, the House delegates will be in flux too. What happens if they can't or don't vote?
So in theory, if the House can't decide on a president, then it could go to the Senate to choose the vice president.
The House's conduct risks a deeply damaging.
And that's a straight up and down vote.
The institutions of American government.
The Senate could decide on a vice president. The vice president would then become president on January 20th.
So, hello, President Pence or Harris?
If the Senate can't decide on a vice president, the Succession Act would kick into gear on January 20th. And under the Succession Act, it would be the leader of the House of Representatives, which is Nancy Pelosi, and she would be president as of January 20th.
The power of the Speaker is awesome. Awesome.
Then, of course, the question becomes whether he'll leave office. And that would come down to whether the Secret Service or potentially even other law enforcement or military would be willing to step in and escort a belligerent president out of the White House pending full resolution of the election.
Wow. Remember back when you could go to bed on election night knowing it was all over? Not this year, I guess. Kim Whaley is a constitutional scholar and law professor. also a former assistant U.S. attorney and associate counsel in the Whitewater investigation. Plus, she writes for the conservative website The Bulwark. Shannon Henry Kleiber reached out to her feeling alarmed.
So I have to say, I find this whole description terrifying, that it could last this long, that it could be so unclear. Could this really happen?
Most election experts will say it's a possibility. I think it is surprising that there is no clear tiebreaker if something like this happens. You know, it could go to the United States Supreme Court. That's why this nomination and potential looks like confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett so close to an election is such a contentious issue.
Kim, some of your work that I like so much is about helping regular people learn more about the voting process and what their rights are. What are the three or so most important things that you would like voters to know and understand right now?
Well, number one is that unlike other constitutional rights like First Amendment, Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment, there is no express right to vote in the original Constitution. And as a result, it depends on your zip code. So your right to vote in Wisconsin is different in terms of how robust it is from your right to vote in, say, Oregon. And that's troubling, that depending on where you live, your access to the ballot varies. The second is that most democracies have what's called an opt-out system. So if you're a member of that country, a citizen, you automatically are registered to vote. Voting rates are much, much higher, and you opt out. In America, the only people who could vote originally were rich white males. We're still having a debate in this country whether the right people should be able to exercise that right. And the third piece really is that there's a lot of ways to fix this. I happen to believe I'd like to see democracy by we the people, not we the politicians or we the Democrats or we the Republicans. You know, I don't care how you vote. I just really do care about voting, because there's so much money in politics taking elected officials out of the business of caring about regular people. And Congress can do a lot to fix that. And so that's the third piece. I think people need to elect members of Congress that are going to fix the electoral process.
How are you personally planning on voting this year? Are you voting in person? Will you send in a ballot? And I know people, I'm sure you do too, who are worried about the mail system. Should we be?
Well, you know, actually, I have sitting on my desk in my home office, I live in Maryland. I registered to vote by mail, and they sent me my ballot by email. I printed it out. I filled it out and signed it, but I'm going to drop it off personally once the polls in Maryland open early in October. And so that's what I'm recommending people do. But I think if you do use a mail-in ballot, read directions meticulously, because over 500,000 were excluded over the summer just because people didn't sign in the right place or didn't sign the envelope, for example. So that's number one. Read it meticulously. Take your time. And secondly, I would really say drop it off. Drop it off physically if you can. You have to have your personal vote plan. I have it on my Instagram, Kim Whaley, as well as on Twitter. It's a 5-step process. You really have to take this into your own hands the same way you get your flu shot every year. It's that level of, okay, I'm going to arm myself and I'm just going to have a plan to make sure my vote counts. Because again, democracy itself is on the ballot. That's what we're voting for. We're voting for democracy versus something else like authoritarianism. And there are many, many people across the political spectrum who agree with me. It's not just hyperbole anymore.
You know, obviously, every election is both historically important and relevant to our everyday lives, but the stakes seem different this year. How do you see that? How are the stakes different?
The stakes are different because we're not debating policy. We're not debating what president is better on climate change, what president is better on immigration, what president is better on the economy, what president is better for me on healthcare, the kitchen table issues. We're debating, do we want democracy, or are we okay with something other than that, which is more like, as I said, authoritarianism, whether it's really unlimited power in the White House, potentially staying in power over the 8-year maximum under the Constitution. Democracy's not set in stone, and we're a pretty young one. This election is not about red versus blue. It's about we the people versus something that's much, much, much darker that I don't even think Americans can comprehend what it'll look like. And that's what keeps me up at night. I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime where we're not debating policy anymore. We're debating whether there's unlimited power in one branch of government, and that's a monarchy, an unlimited monarchy. And that was rejected. That's not an originalist or a textualist point of view. That's fact. The sky is blue. We are not an unlimited monarchy. And that's where we're headed.
Kim, I don't know if you talk publicly about your political affiliations, but can you describe how you would describe them for me?
You know, I don't really. I have clerked or worked with in the Whitewater investigation, which was an investigation of a Democratic president. And I also write for The Bulwark, which is a solidly conservative, historically Republican group of people. But we share the same value system, which is the rule of law, which is a government by the people, which is their tickets for speeding. And even if you're in the presidency, you get tickets for speeding. I'm a person who has a very strong value system. Students ask me all the time, which party should I join? I don't know if I'm Democrat or Republican. My answer is that's the wrong question. The wrong question is, what do you believe in?
The labels are harder right now.
Yeah. We're very results-oriented. We're very conclusion-oriented. We're very team-oriented. And as a law professor and lawyer, I look for the questions. I get curious about the issues. And then, you know, I might support a Republican in one race and a Democrat in another race based on whether they're convincing me that they're in the right place on things for my value system. But that's a different way of thinking. And Shannon, that's my next book, actually.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
I'm underway.
What is the next book?
It's called Common Sense. I think the byline is a lawyer's guide to using legal analysis to make everyday decisions. So it's about what we're talking about, what people pay a lot of money to go to law school. How do you break down these things so that they make sense in a common sense way? And you can empower yourself to make your own decisions. I think that gives people agency. You can have agency by being angry and hating and joining a team, but you can also have agency by educating yourself how to make your own decisions. And so that's book number three, to take legal analysis, which is actually a very sophisticated and productive way of making decisions and reasoning through thorny questions. That's the objective of my next book, which is called Common Sense.
It sounds like something that everybody needs right now. I wanted to go back to something you said about we the people. Is we the people still us in America, or is it changing?
I think it's changed because of money and politics. If we the people want some measured gun reform, then the polling numbers are high, even on Second Amendment stalwarts. They want some measure of gun control. It's not happening. People do want health care. We haven't seen anything out of the Republicans on that, despite many promises. And we might see the end of Obamacare and millions go off the rolls as of the Supreme Court's argument just a week after the election. It's scheduled for November 11th. We're seeing for years massive bipartisan support for some thoughtful immigration reform. Not seeing it. So then it's like, okay, if it's not happening, who are the politicians answering to? And I think the answer is you and I can only give around $2,700 per person to a candidate. Corporations can't give money directly at all. But then in a case called Citizens United, the Supreme Court said, well, what about putting ads in newspapers or on television? That's speech. And the court said, well, by the way, corporations have First Amendment rights too. Well, the difference between a corporation and you and me is I don't have $100 million to run national ads on fracking, for example. They can spend unlimited amounts, but the candidates understand this. People understand who is actually getting them elected when they turn on the TV or they look at Facebook. That's the shift. Politicians get in office with money. You ask anybody who's run for office, it's money, money, money. They think about that the minute they wake up to the minute they go to bed. Even after they're elected, they think about that. So if the money that's actually funding the campaigns and getting people in office are the money that flood through the First Amendment onto the airwaves and into our phones, and it's unlimited because of the First Amendment, and it's coming from corporations, that's who they're answering to. They're not answering to individual voters. I believe the way to change that is to get people to vote and not half the eligible voters, which is the number right now, but 60, 70, 89%, like that happens in Sweden and Australia and Belgium and these other places that have mandatory automatic registration. I think it's going to be harder for corporations to dominate, and wealthy people, frankly, to dominate how our elected officials do things. I mean, just think about it. $3 trillion in tax cuts under this government, but they cannot figure out how to give Americans much needed aid in a pandemic when they've lost their jobs and many cannot even feed their children. That's all you need to know that the system isn't working. And the answer is to get out and vote.
Yes, I believe. Well, I believe in my soul.
Shannon Henry Kleiber talked with constitutional law scholar Kim Whaley. Her most recent book is called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Coming up, how the Voting Rights Act got gutted. Plus, things people say while standing in line waiting to vote. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Early voting has already begun in my state. And so how are actual voters feeling about the election so far?
I'm confident in our election process. I'm also confident that a lot of people don't engage with the election process because of the way it's set up.
I have talked to so many of my friends. You know, they're nervous about voting.
I've had votes that don't count. I've had attempts at registering that have failed.
They're nervous about making sure that their ballot gets turned in and nervous about the postal service.
Even last election we had in the state, our absentee ballots came in after the election.
I feel very concerned about this election given the rhetoric that our current president has been sharing.
Early voters in Madison, Wisconsin. So how did we get here? 240 plus years of democracy, and Americans are still worried about whether their vote will be counted? Well, maybe you've heard of Carol Anderson, author of White Rage and One Person, No Vote. She told Steve Paulson people are right to be worried, because when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, it triggered a new wave of voter suppression.
It came to the fore in that ridiculous, god-awful 2000 election.
I move that this board conduct a manual recount of all the ballots for the presidential election for the year 2000.
Everybody remembers that election.
The punch hole is called a Chad.
That was the election of the hanging Chad.
The pregnant Chad.
This is the election where George W. Bush squeaked it out in Florida over Al Gore.
Yes.
May God bless our new president.
And it's still hotly contested, let's face it, because there was just so much that went wrong in Florida.
I guess I better go write an inaugural speech.
But we spend so much time on Florida, we miss what happened in Missouri. In Missouri, in St. Louis, Missouri, the St. Louis Board of Elections illegally purged nearly 50,000 voters off of the rolls shortly before the election and didn't tell them. And so these voters show up to vote and find out their names aren't on the rolls. They're looking, going, wait, what? And the poll workers are like, but you're not here. I can't let you vote. You're not here.
And they're trying to call down to the Board of Elections. Nobody's answering the phone. The lines are jammed. I mean, it's just bad. And so the poll workers just send everybody down to the Board of Elections to get it worked out. Hours are dripping by on election day. So the polls are getting ready to close at 7 p.m. and the Board of Elections is still packed and they can't figure it all out. And so the Democrats sued to get the polls open until 10 o'clock. A judge agreed, saying this is not the voters' fault. They were on the rolls. They were purged illegally. They have a right to vote. The Republicans came behind and sued in a higher court, and that judge shut down the polls at 7:45. What the Republicans said was that keeping the polls open an additional 3 hours,
but especially in Missouri,
was an attempt at massive voter fraud.
Widespread vote fraud.
That this was an attempt to have dead people voting.
And I have respect for the dearly departed.
People using addresses from numerous vacant lots so that they could vote over and over and over and steal the elections.
We've been told by professors that vote fraud doesn't really exist.
Voter fraud.
Voter fraud.
Voter fraud.
Voter fraud.
Voter fraud.
Well, gang, come down out of your ivory towers. We can explain it to you.
Well, none of this was true. It's not massive. It's not rampant. Justin Levitt, a law professor out of California, he did a study. From 2000 to 2014, he counted up all of the votes in the elections in the United States and found 1 billion votes.
A billion ballots.
In those 1 billion votes, he found 31 cases.
31 known incidents.
Of voter fraud out of 1 billion.
Billion with a B.
What you're describing is just so blatantly anti-democratic. It's sort of stunning to think that this could happen in the United States, isn't it? Am I just being, like, incredibly naive here?
Yes. Part of this is part of the old playbook out of the rise of old Jim Crow, where southern states had somewhere between 35 to over 50% of their populations being African American around about 1890. And they were figuring out, how do we stop black people from voting? We do not want black people to vote.
To be detrimental to your safety, continue this march.
But how do we do that and stay on this side of the 15th Amendment, which guarantees the right to vote?
Go home or go to your church.
That the right to vote shall not be abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And so they had to sit down and figure out, how do we look like we're adhering to the 15th Amendment when we're absolutely systematically violating it? That's democracy in America. America has really only had this growing, vibrant democracy that we think of since the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Millions of Americans are denied the right to vote because of their color.
What the Voting Rights Act did was that any change the states wanted to make to their voting laws now had to be reviewed by the U.S. Department of Justice to ensure that they weren't racially discriminatory.
This law will ensure them the right to vote.
If they were racially discriminatory, the U.S. Department of Justice was going to shut it down, and it could not be implemented. When the act was reauthorized in 2006, it came out that the Department of Justice had blocked over 700 changes because those laws were going to be racially discriminatory. They were creating obstacles, hurdles. The U.S. Department of Justice said no. Having over 700 of those changes blocked, to me, sent a signal that racism may still be a factor in America. But Chief Justice John Roberts and 4 other justices, including Clarence Thomas, didn't see it that way.
I have the opinion of the court this morning in case 1296, Shelby County versus Holder.
They gutted the Voting Rights Act.
We have no choice but to find that it violates the Constitution.
After Shelby County v. Holder,
it just unleashed a wave of voter suppression laws.
This bill is uncivil.
2 hours later,
unconstitutional, unnecessary.
After the decision was read, Texas passed its voter ID law.
And we will challenge it.
It was just sitting there waiting in the wings to be unleashed, and it was racially discriminatory.
Things have changed.
That provision may have been necessary 48
years ago. The problem has been forced. This is a
state. We will fight every step of the way.
You know what I find sort of just weird, disturbing about all of this is you would think that a country would want to make voting as easy as possible, right? You would want everyone to vote. And in fact, there are a number of countries around the world that have mandatory voting. 22 countries, including Australia, Brazil, Belgium, Greece, Egypt, the Congo, Thailand, Mexico. In all those countries, voting is actually compulsory. The U.S. has gone in the opposite direction.
We have one set of states that are figuring out how do we stop as many of our citizens from voting as possible. Then we have another slew of our states that are figuring out how do we open up voting to as many of our citizens as possible. So we have Oregon, for instance, that implemented automatic voter registration so that the moment you have some dealings with the Department of Motor Vehicles, you are automatically registered to vote. You have to opt out, say, no, I don't want to vote. People aren't going to opt out, right? So and what happened in Oregon? Oregon already had one of the highest voter turnout rates in the nation. And they weren't satisfied. After automatic voter registration, their voting turnout rate went up by 4 percentage points. And their electorate became even more diverse. California looked at this and said, wow, we want a piece of that. Added automatic voter registration and then put a new twist on it. Said, we want young people to vote, so we're going to pre-register 16 and 17-year-olds to vote. So when they turn 18, they are automatically registered to vote. So you have this nation moving in two separate, distinct directions, and it is wreaking havoc on the nation as a whole. We are going to have a reckoning. I think that this upcoming election is going to be one of those bellwethers for what kind of nation we're going to be.
Okay, let's suppose you were the voting rights czar of the United States. If there were such a thing, what would the voting rules be in this country?
Oh, I would, one, reinstitute a new Voting Rights Act. It has been stalled in Congress. I would have automatic voter registration. I would have same-day registration as well. I would ensure that we had multiple ways for people to vote so that if you don't have the mobility to get to the polling station, that your voice is not silenced. I would have real civic education so we understand how powerful and meaningful the vote really is. Yeah.
So we'll see what happens in the coming years.
Yes, that would be great. That would be great. What would be great is that those who say they believe in democracy act like they believe in democracy and do what it takes in order to have a true, vibrant democracy. And that's not where we are.
Historian Carol Anderson. She's the author of White Rage and One Person, No Vote. She talked with Steve Paulson. You know, listening to that kind of makes me wonder if we have ever achieved true democracy in this country. Historian Jeremy Suri says the bad news is American democracy has always been a work in progress. But don't despair. As he told Charles Monroe Kane, that's also the good news.
You know, I'm among those historians who see democracy as a roller coaster. It goes up and down. Mm. It's not a straight line. We like to think that every generation gets better at this thing called democracy. It's not true. Some generations, because of their circumstances, do better, and some don't. And we're at a low point, but we're moving to a high point, I think, right now. We're at a low point in participation. We're at a low point in engagement. And we're in a low point in the rotation of power. All those things, the way they operate in our society today, our founders would be astounded and dismayed. But I feel like we're climbing back up again now. The Black Lives Matter movement was the largest social movement in American history. Almost all the activities were peaceful, and they involved more white people than black people, in fact. That's engagement. That's what democracy is about. And this is often the case, Charles, that in our low moments, it's the marginalized groups that lead us back up the hill of democracy.
Okay. I smelled hope leaning forward. But then I start thinking about Jim Crow, voting under Jim Crow, you know, poll tax and having to read the Constitution or memorize the Bill of Rights before you can vote, which went on for quite a long time. My cynical hat says, have things really gotten better? Aren't we living in times like that right now?
Well, I think they've gotten better and worse at the same time. And that's the dynamic of history. Hegel called this dialectics, right?
Right.
At the moment when you see the greatest change, you also see the greatest resistance. So let's take the American South that you just talked about. You're absolutely right. And I've written actually a number of things. In fact, that the governor is very angry at me here in Texas because I said that he's actually practicing Jim Crow in his efforts to restrict voting, using the same language, in fact. But why is he doing that? He's doing that because Texas, like many other states, is on the verge of becoming a majority-minority state, with more and more voters who are not your traditional Texan voters or your traditional Southern voters. They are more active and engaged than they've ever been, and they don't support the parties in power. So you're seeing those in power trying wherever they can to hold this inevitable push back. And that's the space we're in now. In some ways, those who are trying to repress the vote, and they definitely are today, they're fighting their Alamo. You know, this is their last stand because they know after we get more voters in, they're out.
You know, I'm sitting here, I kind of got the Alamo stuck on my head, and I started thinking about some of the details and how long it was and how many people died. Do we really have to go through all this pain to get there?
Unfortunately, yes. I think if there's one truism about American history, it's that peaceful change is a myth. We're a very violent society. We don't teach it that way. We're a very, very violent society. Even the Congressional Research Service has pointed out that there are very few years in our entire history when we have not been at war. We don't always call it war, but if you define war as the organized use of violence against a group defined as a threat, we have the highest incarceration rate of any peer society. That's a kind of violence, right? We're a very violent society, and people in our society have never given up power peacefully. The process of historical change is always painful, and that is precisely what we're living through right now. And the 200,000 plus people who have died from COVID are casualties of that war right now that we're fighting.
I want to talk about something that's not so practical, and that is confidence. Let me give you an example, and I think this example scares me. My wife, who happens to work in government, she and I filled out our absentee ballots weeks ago, and I was going to mail them. I actually had them in the mailbox in the front of our house. And my wife said, no. What if they don't get counted? So she took them to the local clerk and had them stamped. And then you get a little number telling you, like a serial number of where it went. She wasn't confident that it would make it through the mail system and get counted. I think that's really scary that she's actually worried that her vote's not going to get counted that way.
Well, I think, first of all, this is not a new phenomenon. It's new to us who lived through the last 35, 40 years when we had pretty fair elections. But, you know, our elections have always been fraught with politics and efforts to count some ballots and not others. Lyndon Johnson, when he was elected to the Senate in 1948, he was famously known as Landslide Lyndon because there was a county in Texas where these dead people seemed to vote for him in alphabetical order, in fact. So this is not a new phenomenon, but it is a case where we have the opportunity to make progress. And the way to make progress is to do exactly what your wife did, not just take your ballot somewhere where you know it will be received, but to actually track our voting. That is how it worked in the 19th century. When the elections were small enough, you would actually vote and you would see that your vote was counted.
Right. You know, the majority of American voting age Americans don't vote. What do you do with those people?
So in the late 19th century, we actually had very high voter turnout rates. We had about 80%.
Wow.
Now, of course, it was a bounded electorate. It was white males for the most part. Right. So it really wasn't 80% of the population. But the things they did to make that possible, we could do again today for a larger electorate. In the late 19th century, you didn't have to register to vote. You just went and voted and proved that you were who you were, or you could register the day of. In that period, you were able to leave work to go vote. It was not an official holiday, but there was the presumption that actually you went because they wanted you to vote for their guy or whoever the company was or the local union was. So, you know, if we made, as we're starting to this year, right, if we made, many companies are doing this, right, if you make Election Day a holiday, if you make it easier to register, and we could also say that it's actually a constitutional duty and require one to go to vote. Australia does that.
Yeah, that would be interesting, right?
And you could still then go to vote and vote none of the above. You would not be forced to make a choice you don't want to make. I think people should have the right to vote none of the above, but you would still have to actually go and vote. And maybe that's the route we want to go.
I have two questions for you that I've been thinking about a lot. And the first one is, Donald Trump wins the election. It's the 20th of January. There's no transition of power. What does it look like in America if there's no longer democracy?
Well, I don't think the election of Donald Trump would be the end of democracy, but it would sink us very deeply into a violent, conflictual moment, because many of his efforts are an attack upon what people believe are democratic rights, the right to speak, their right to have honest news and information, their right to have some access to health insurance, their right for their state not to be mistreated because the president doesn't like the governor. And I think we're on the edge of people then massively responding through disobedience and through possible violence. It wouldn't be the end of democracy, but it would become a very violent moment in our democracy. We're on the edge of that now, in fact.
Wow. I can't believe we're having this conversation. I think I know how you're going to answer this, but I want to ask you, I find it hard to believe America, arguably the most powerful country in the history of the world. It makes me feel like our democracy is weak if it can't handle fill in the blank. How come we can't handle this?
Well, I don't think it is because of Trump. He's definitely the most anti-democratic president we have ever had. But we have come to this point because of all the people who have enabled him. The Republicans in the Senate who have not been willing to hold him accountable. One can have one's own opinion on impeachment and conviction. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about requiring that the executive agencies that work for the president don't do his political bidding, but instead do their jobs. The Justice Department has been manipulated by the Attorney General. The Department of Homeland Security has gone way off the reservation. Every single director of the Department of Homeland Security since this one, and this one was not even legally appointed, every one of them, including Republican Tom Ridge, who is very close to George W. Bush, have said the Department of Homeland Security is not doing its job. It's acting as the goons for the president. And we could go on and on with a long list of that. All of these agencies, they get every dollar from Congress. And the Republicans have been unwilling to hold them accountable. They are the ones to blame. You want to protect our democracy, get people in the Senate who actually care about democracy and are not stooges to a party.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think about it. I had a friend who was like, you know, what Trump's done for us is a favor. He's exposed all the holes in the dike we need to fix.
Yes.
Do you feel like maybe that's the silver lining as well? We're like, hey, okay.
Absolutely. That's why I think we can do better. The horrible moment exposes, as you said, the rot, and it mobilizes us to do something about it. That's why George Floyd mattered. That's why Bull Connor mattered in the 1960s, right? That's why the Selma March was so important, right? When they beat John Lewis and those peaceful civil rights activists walking across Edmund Pettus Bridge, it showed the world how horrible this was. You couldn't pretend it wasn't there anymore. When George Floyd was lynched in front of us all, you could no longer deny that there's a problem of police brutality. And so we have to act now. We can't pretend it's not there. Trump has done that for us, and that is the engine of change. We can pretend things are fine until it's pushed in our face. This is what Martin Luther King understood, that you have to expose in order to motivate.
You know, it's funny. I didn't think you were going to be this optimistic in the interview, but then I started thinking while you were talking, oh, you're a historian. You're basing things on the history of America. Most people are looking to the future, right? oh my God, this could happen, this could happen. Is that you find the history is makes one optimistic because things tend to work themselves out?
So I became a historian because I think what history shows us is that every moment that we're in is filled with all different kinds of potential. And that potential comes from a long past that we don't see. One of the problems of not seeing history is you underrate the options that you have. You think all you can do is what's in front of you. And by looking back, it's not that you will replay the past, but is that the past widens the range of possibility for the present because you can learn from what others have been through and see possibilities in your own world. And I think when we look into the American past, we can see that our democracy has been a roller coaster. We've had some terrible moments, not just the Civil War, Jim Crow, the Great Depression. And we have made it through, not with Pollyannish thinking. We've made it through because those moments have mobilized people, often non-traditional actors, often young people, to get involved and force change into the future. And that's where we are today. And if we can get through this moment, we can start to do that good work.
Wow. I was ready for a different interview. I was ready for something more dark and more negative. And I find your optimism refreshing. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. I do think we're on the cusp of a positive turning point and we just have to get ourselves through it. And if we don't, it'll be disastrous.
So there you go. The stakes are low.
That, exactly.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles.
Jeremy Suri is a historian at the University of Texas at Austin and author of The Impossible Presidency. And he was talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Coming up, how to put the fun back in elections. And if you don't think it's possible, stick around. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and BRX. Probably not the only one who feels worn out by this election season and more than ready to have it all over. What if elections weren't such a grind, though? I mean, what if voting was fun? I know, I can't really imagine it either, but political strategist Eric Liu can.
Actually, for most of American history, until pretty much the advent of television, there was this deep, robust, raucous participatory culture of voting that was about street theater and parties and open-air debates and festivals and competing parades and theatricality and spectacle. If you think back to some of the signal moments in American political history, the pre-revolutionary era, and you think about this very fertile, fervent culture of pamphleteering and outdoor orations. And then you fast forward to something like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and, you know, that was the entertainment of its day.
Can you tell me about a couple of the projects that you've gotten started? You've got this whole Make Elections, Make Voting Fun Again campaign at a pretty local level.
This is a project called The Joy of Voting. So in Miami, one of the projects is about young people organizing these all-night dance parties with really great DJs and performers, where the only way you get in is to show that you're registered to vote. In Philadelphia, there's a great scavenger hunt that is elections-themed all through Colonial Old Town. And in Wichita, Local residents and artists are creating mixtapes and graffiti art that's about both getting out the vote and reminding people why voting matters. And again, in the best sense, the bigger picture that voting is part of.
Why does that bodies in the street thing matter to you? Why does it matter to you that this is in person, in a place?
That's such a great question. You know, I think it matters particularly in our age where so much of our lives, you know, are mediated and we deal with one another through our screens. We are not, we literally are not seeing each other with our heads and necks craned looking down at our smartphones. You know, I think in a country as diverse and far-flung as ours, there is so little naturally holding us together. And the only way to build these deep bonds of trust is to see one another.
Yeah, that's such an interesting comment because I'm thinking about how many people today, and sometimes I'm one of them, feel pretty cynical about the entire democratic process in America and don't really think their individual votes are going to matter all that much. You know, the deck is already stacked. The campaigns are run by a cadre of professional operatives. They're supported by armies of big data miners and funded by special interests and big money. And on the face of that, wearing an I voted sticker just seems kind of futile.
I don't deny that it seems kind of futile. It may feel that way in a national election where votes are counted in the tens of millions. But where this really matters, think about your town. In a country where in most local elections, turnout hovers at about 20%. If you decided that you wanted to get you and your friends' friends to actually vote and show up in a local election, just you and your social network literally could turn the tide in a local election. That's enough to get a different kind of council member, to get a different kind of interest represented, to get a different array of power at your local level.
Well, this is the real underlying issue, isn't it? It's about power. You've said in a bunch of different places that one of the big problems you think facing American democracy right now is that a lot of Americans have become illiterate in power. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Power, just that word. I mean, I bet some of our listeners, as we're talking about this now, their hackles have gone up. Power is a dirty word in American life, and all of our associations with power are kind of negative. People are power hungry or power mad or on power trips. And I think one of the most basic responsibilities that we have as citizens is to be able with unflinching eyes to name, to understand, to be able to read and write power. Power is a gift. We begin with a certain measure of power, all of us, even the ones who seem to have the least in material ways. And consciously or not, we are continuously either giving that power away or we are directing it and circulating it intentionally. For instance, back to voting, when you decide that boy, the system is so rigged and the choices are terrible and this whole thing is corrupt, I'm not going to bother voting. That's a fantasy. There is no such thing as not voting.
What do you mean?
Not voting is voting. It is voting to hand over your power and your voice to other people whose interests are most likely going to be inimical to your own.
Is that what you mean when you talk about becoming power literate as opposed to power illiterate? Simply knowing to begin with, say, mapping the power in your local community. How much do you know about it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we use a phrase oftentimes in everyday life. We talk about the power structure, right? But what is the power structure? I break down the power structure into this combination of sources of power plus the conduits of power. There are various sources of power, whether that's money power, people power, the power of force and violence, the power of state action, the power of social norms, right? There are all these different sources, but what are the conduits through which they flow? In some communities, the main conduits are going to be formal channels like the Chamber of Commerce or the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. In other communities, it's not going to be that so much. The conduits of power are going to be this lunch table at the steakhouse where the third Tuesday of every month, a few bankers and big shots get together and map out what's going to happen. Mapping those sources and conduits is what I mean by being literate in power, being literally able to see these flows all around you. It's like, you remember the movie The Matrix at the end when the Matrix becomes visible, right, to Neo, and you see that continuous stream of data and bits and the flow all around you. Like, just envision that, man. I mean, that's happening all around us. And if we start seeing that flow, that suffusing flow of power and our ability actually to redirect it, that changes both mindset and action.
To circle back to a couple of things we began with, fun and adding a sense of play back to the whole electoral democratic process and the notion of imagination. You created an exercise a while ago, a kind of thought experiment that you challenged people to try. And I wanted to invite our listeners to do this. And maybe you could explain.
Sure. One of the most simple, well, simple but challenging exercises I think we as citizens can do is just to write a narrative of what your city could look like in the future. How, if power were truly circulated equitably and people had more wherewithal, more opportunity to participate more fully in the civic life of your community, what would that look like? And when you begin to depict what that city looks like, and it can be in 3 years, it can be in 30 years, but when you begin to make that depiction in your mind and then start telling that story to other people, I mean this in the most profound sense, it becomes self-fulfilling. Any political movement of the last half century, whether it was the conservative movement or the civil rights movement, all of these movements began with people basically telling and writing down this kind of narrative, envisioning what that polity of the future would look like, and then working backwards from that and thinking, okay, who and what do we need to mobilize in order to get from here to there?
Eric Liu is the founder and CEO of Citizen University. He was a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for Bill Clinton. And so, having heard all that, how would you change voting in America?
It should be as easy as possible.
I think that the more opportunity that you give people to vote, the better.
If you could vote by going outside and just dropping it off and like a drone comes and gets it, as long as it's fair and, you know, there's no fraud, then the more the better is what I think. Probably get over a two-party system wouldn't hurt too.
You know, voter suppression is real and alive in America.
At no point is, like, you know, fighting for more accessibility to vote a bad thing.
This means a lot. This is the first time I can vote.
Oh, yeah.
And the 20 years I've been here. I can't believe it.
Whether it's your first or your 50th election, I have one word for you. Vote. We'll be right there with you this year. Voting, watching, and waiting. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by a Democratic collective whose members are Shannon Henry Kleiber, Charles Monroe Kane, Angelo Bautista, Mark Rickers, Joe Hartke, Steve Paulson, and me, Anne Strandchamps. Be well and join us again next time.